David Milch, my old friend from Yale, has been called television's first artistic genius. And one of the people who has called him that is me. His powerful dramas and often disturbing, bizarre dramas that he conceives have troubled the censors in the networks for more than 25 years, and also in Congress. And these dramas have explored human weakness and violence in disturbing and, I believe, very artful ways. He's one of television's most honored writers, has won all kinds of prizes for particular episodes of individual shows, and his most significant credits are Hill Street Blues, for which he wrote episodes that won a number of prizes, NYPD Blue, which he co-created with Stephen Bochco, and most of all, in some respects, and there's a kind of progression here that we may get a chance to talk about today, the show that's running on HBO now, a pioneering Western, one of the great Westerns, I think, in American cultural history, a show called Deadwood. My hope is and expectation is that many of you, without even realizing it, because people don't remember the names of television writers or creators that much, that many of you have probably seen episodes of television programs that David Milch has written. As I mentioned, David is an old comrade of mine. We met when David was really a graduate student level at Yale when I was beginning my career as a professor. And we had various kinds of contact, including a meeting with David in which he heard that I had been interested in media, and he showed me a kind of a short film that he made in a truck stop in West Haven, right near the exit for Yale University, that was full of the same bizarre humor and black creativity that's characteristic of his work even to this day. I thought we might begin by showing, by playing a clip and having, hey Wally, and nice to see you. Hope you're all right. I thought we might begin by showing a clip from an episode of one of David's shows, and it's a very brief one, but it illustrates some qualities that I think are characteristic of his work. I think he actually has written these scenes, but even if not, his hand is all over them, and his creative energies are in it. And it dramatizes two characters that I hope we can get a chance to talk about, because David's a great creator of character. So could we show the first clip? David, you'll have to look behind you.
All right. I wonder if I can do it.
Sure.
Still no sound.
Can we have some sound?
That's not 20 pounds, Norm. Which 20 pounds, Norm, gets broads and limousines and a house anywhere
maybe
you
they can
think
start
of,
it over again.
And not 40 pounds.
Now back it up a little bit more.
This is a...
Let's set the scene, David.
A suitcase of cocaine has fallen from the sky. From a Cessna, and Sid, who is a snitch, an informant for this detective, is trying to tempt Bunce to leave the life of the law.
Right. Bunce is the cop, of course, from Hill Street Blues.
From Hill Street Blues.
It's water, Norm. We could set up by any water in the whole stinking world.
And it's not 10 pounds, Norm. That's not the amount.
That's not 20 pounds, Norm. Which 20 pounds, Norm, gets broads and limousines and a house anywhere you could think of. And not 40 pounds. Not even 60 pounds, Norm, which is $750,000. Norm, 80 pounds. 80 pounds, Norm. That kid's intestines were down in his testicles with a weighted ass suitcase. Norm, I am going to ask you a question once. And I don't think you would respect me as a man if I didn't. That Bobby, he's a mouse. He is looking to off this stuff for high four figures. 7,500, 10 grand max. 10 grand. Knowing the kind of person you are, I wouldn't be surprised if you don't have that in a bank account somewhere, am I right? And that Bobby is out of the picture. And you and me, Norm, are struggling like this with that suitcase between us. I know that you are in law enforcement, but I'm asking you as a human being to consider the possibility of an entire fresh concept and start in life. Okay, Norm, I'm gonna take my hand away from your lips now. It would mean, Norm, so much to me if you gave me some positive indication that you would consider what I am suggesting. Is there a glimmer, Norm? Is there any possibility?
None.
Okay.
None in the sense of what?
None.
None in the sense of what?
I forgot about that coda since that comes up. David, let's start by talking a little bit about those characters.
Yeah.
Let's start with the secondary characters, or the one who did most of the talking,
yeah.
Sid. And talk Sid. About what he represented in the show for you, why he was helpful.
You know, Sid, I think, is kind of a Falstaff character. He is cheerfully amoral. And I think an interesting counterpart to Bunce, who is a detective in the Hill Street Police Department, but I think secretly Bunce is a guy who's fundamentally uncomfortable in his own skin. His clothes don't fit him right. He's always doing this. And I think Sid represents the inner Norm, kind of set free. And what Bunce does is he's constantly belittling and belaboring that inner part of himself, which would like to step out a little bit into the world. And this is kind of the reductio ad absurdum of that, with the idea of the, you know, every cop, if he's honest, always dreams of the situation where in absolute anonymity, he could make off with 100 pounds of cocaine. And here is Sid embodying that possibility.
One of the interesting things about this sequence that we saw, of course, is the character played by Dennis Franz, who has had a kind of collaborative relationship with David for a long time. I was thinking, David, that you might talk a little bit about Franz's work and the evolution of his character.
Yeah.
Change his names and so forth.
Yeah. I came to Hill Street after it had been on for a couple of years, and there was so much about its approach, the multiple storylines, and that to which I gravitated. But I didn't feel I felt that it was a bit of a sanitized version of what police work was, having been incarcerated myself on a number of occasions, always through false accusations and misunderstandings. So when I came on, the first character that I introduced was a character named Sal Benedetto, who was a bad cop, who was always beating up Charlie Haid and so on, and who seemed to me to be a more accurate representation of at least one aspect of policing. And Benedetto wound up robbing a bank, and they send a robot in. He was hiding in the vault, and they send a robot in so they can watch what he's doing. And he starts beating the robot with his fists. And, you know, he's a kind of he's a Luddite. You know, he hates technology. He hates all of it. Anyway, in those days, you couldn't have such a cop as a regular, and they made me kill him. But then several years later, I was put in charge of the show, and so I brought the character back as Bunce, this guy. And then we did a spinoff where he was a private detective. And then when I did NYPD Blue, I asked Dennis if he would play a similar character named Sipowicz, who was supposed to die at the end of the first episode. And he agreed, stipulating that he wanted to be killed because it was the 173rd cop he had played. So once we had him under contract, I admitted I had fibbed. And he stayed with the show 12 years. I left after the seventh season. But Sipowicz is actually Now, you won't, it's hard to believe this, but, you know, I think so much of our creative process is unconscious. And my father's mother's name was Sapwich. And it never occurred to me till a number of years into NYPD Blue that there might be any connection between those things. But he is a character who had a lot of traits that my dad had. And I think that one of the opportunities of my life has been the chance to discover love for complicated personalities such as that. And so he's a guy that I have a lot of affection for.
One way to think about Sipowicz's character is to see him as a character that you never finished with, David.
Because yeah.
One could argue that there's a connection between Sipowicz and
Swearingen
in Deadwood. I have some clips from Deadwood that we'll show in a little while that will clarify Swearingen's complex humane monstrosity. David seems to have a gift for creating monstrous characters who have human qualities that you identify with. And I'm wondering whether you're aware either of how horrible they seem, but also of how human they seem when you're actually working on it.
Yeah. Well, you know, my old man used to beat me pretty good. And I adored him. And he wound up taking his life. And so... you know, and in fact, you know, a colleague of ours about whom you were speaking earlier, R.W.B. Lewis. Now, this will show you how complicated my old man was.
R.W.B. Lewis is a very distinguished Yale professor who published a number of important books. One of which is a biography of Edith Wharton. Did it win the Pulitzer?
Yeah.
It won the Pulitzer Prize. The truth of the matter is, I said I wasn't going to say this in public, but I will. Most of that book, a good part of that book, was written by David Milch. And David is acknowledged incredibly generously in the beginning of that book, but not generously enough. And R.W.B. Lewis admitted this to me, because I was his junior colleague. David was a sort of inspired graduate student who was treated by the Yale faculty as some fair-haired boy. I'm sure that many members of the Yale faculty would be very disappointed to see that David became a famous writer of television programs instead of a professor.
Anyways... we were doing, Dick and I, R.W.B. Lewis and I, had a project called The James Family, about Henry and William James and so on, and we were down at the National Endowment getting dough for, I was writing the scripts and he was writing the book. And while we're down there, Dick was called out of the room while we were pitching, and we finished, and afterwards we went out and we had some coffee, and I said, well, I think it went pretty well, blah, blah, blah. We're talking for a while. About 10 minutes in, he said, listen, when I was called out of the room, they were telling me that your father had died and had taken his life, and his instructions were that you were not to be told until after the pitch was finished. Just to go into to be absolutely inappropriate in describing the kind of torment that some souls are exposed to. My dad was the only child of the eldest of 10 children, and her name, as I say, was Sapwich, her last name. And several of his uncles were, in fact, contemporaries of his, and one of them was even younger than he was. They were all in the rackets. But because he was of the next generation, he had to go to college, and he became a very prominent surgeon and a professor of surgery, and as did my brother, my older brother. But he was always drawn to... he was very frustrated by his professional identity, and we would, in August every year, he would take us up to Saratoga to the racetrack where all of his family would congregate, And I remember, you might be old enough to remember this, there was the Kefauver hearings, which are dramatized in The Godfather, where the Congress is doing an investigation into the mob. And I remember the real Kefauver hearings. I would come home every day. There must have been 25 wise guys living in our house for over a year, because my dad would do hernia operations on them so they wouldn't have to go and testify, you know, before the Kefauver committee. So it was a very complicated sort of relationship between learning. He was a very well recognized surgeon and so on, and this other darker part of his personality. And his identity as a physician was the sort of civilizing aspect of this. My dad was a narcotic addict, he was an alcoholic, he was all the stuff that I became. Anyways, towards the end of his life, my brother, who had also become a surgeon and sort of idolized my dad the same way I did, took over my father's care. And my dad would engage in self-mutilation and all sorts of unpleasant things. And in his tormented mind, because his sense of self was so associated with his professional identity as a physician, he became convinced that since my brother had become the caregiver in the family, my brother was having sexual relations with my mother.
Oh, God.
And took his life in front of them to punish them for that.
This is worse than Deadwood, David.
And then his last words were, "Don't tell David until he's done."
Oh.
With his pitch. So I tell you that. Let me hurry to say that I am a very happy and grateful person. And I was saying in a class a little while ago that the future is constantly in the process of interpreting the meaning of the past. I'll give you a quick example of that. My brother, who was a surgeon, in the aftermath of my dad's passing, retrained himself as a hospice physician to care for the terminally ill, and has established hospice programs in Romania, in Poland, in Hungary, runs a hospice in Buffalo, New York, where we're from. And I choose to believe that my father, in many ways, was instrumental in his own inability to accept himself, in teaching my brother that there was another way to be a physician. I think that the fundamental responsibility of a medical practitioner is not curative, it's pastoral. I will walk with you into whatever darkness may come. So I also believe that my experience, I didn't volunteer this information. Professor Thorburn asked me a question, and I try to answer it honestly. That I'll tell you one more story, if I may.
Okay.
May I? Very quickly. When I started to write out there, I won a lot of prizes, and one of which is the Humanitas Prize, which is given by the Catholic Church for the most uplifting, whatever it is. 15 grand tax-free. And I kept winning this thing. And at that point, I was a heroin addict, very bitter, blah, blah, blah. So I would make it my business whenever I would come back to get the next award to tell the priest, Father, I can't remember his name. Anyways, I said, I'm sure it will please you to know that I took that money and bought a racehorse with it, which is what the church probably would have wanted me to do, trying to scandalize him. And He would, and I hated this guy. I just hated him. And I could never figure out why I hated him so much. And I said, he had his buck teeth and his stupid. Anyways, it was like he knew something about, he would look at you and he'd smile. It's like he knew something about you you didn't know about yourself. I hate people like that. So, anyways, years go by and I won a few more times. And finally, I got sober. And I had the opportunity, finally, when I won this award again, I said, you know, I've never liked whatever this guy's name is, Father so-and-so. I don't like the way he looks. I don't like his buck teeth. He was sitting right next to me. And I said, and the thing I really didn't like is that he always had his smile when I would try to offend him, like he knew something about me I didn't know about myself. I said, and I thank God that I have lived long enough to have come to understand that the shadow in which I felt that all of my characters had to move and live, in fact, was cast by God's sheltering hand. And that's what the Father knew about me that I didn't know about myself. So that's all I say about that.
I hate to turn to sort of less somber themes, but one way to do this, I think, maybe to pick up on what David was saying about doctors. As he was talking, I had two reactions. One was, I heard Dennis Franz, I'm absolutely amazed by the closeness with which the dialogue that Dennis Franz speaks in at least three different shows sounds like David Milch's ordinary talk. And it tells you something about how close he actually is to that character. And something of what he said also, I think, about some of the terrible aspects of his own autobiography that material has clearly seeped into his work in very interesting ways. And maybe I could dramatize some of that for you and also get some interesting commentary from David by showing you a passage here. Let's take a look at this. Hopefully very brief. But keep your hand on the...
Oh. Don't fall over, David. I got big plans for you.
Now, I'm not sure where this is on the tape, so let me see it. I may have you back it up once we see what's there. Yes, this is good. No, back it up. You see what we're seeing. Fast backwards to the very beginning of the tape. It won't be long. This is the doctor on Deadwood, of course. Brad Dourif is the actor. Surely the greatest role he's ever had in his career. And this is a particularly melodramatic moment, which I'll show. You'll see why.
The sick minister, yeah.
This would be the late... when David and I knew each other, it would be the early and mid-70s.
I graduated in 1966. I was expelled from the law school in 1968. Falsely accused.
Okay, go a little further. I want to show them the boot. Okay, you can do it from right here.
And pain or discomfort, don't you be the doctor. You report the symptoms. I will determine their significance.
Doc.
I am yelling because I want to make sure you goddamn understand me.
I do. I understand.
He's a cerebral palsy and a club foot, and he's fashioned a boot to help her walk.
Here's your goddamn boot.
Help me put it on.
Okay, stop it now. We'll continue. We'll leave it right here. We're going to continue in a minute. David, let's talk a little bit about that, and then we'll go on.
Well, let's see. The doc was a guy who was sort of is kind of a figure out of Conrad. You know, remember Dr. Monaghan and Nostromo? The guy who broke under torture. He broke in the Civil War, the doc. And he's a kind of exile, as so many of the characters in Deadwood are. Because, you know, it wasn't that everybody died because he was amputating, you know, without any in unhygienic circumstances, but that they died screaming. And so he's become kind of a drunk, and he's come to Deadwood because his radically asocial nature is the norm rather than the exception. This the trouble is that this girl asks him to try to help her to walk around, and he's afraid to fail, but he goes ahead and does this, and simultaneously there's a minister on the show who's got a tumor.
We're going to see that episode in a second. We'll show that
in
a second.
And so he's having a bad day today.
The sense that the doctor is not just a tortured figure, he's also an alcoholic. He spends a lot of his time on the show drunk out of his mind when he's not tending to patients. And he's an example of this kind of double character that Milch seems to create with greater and greater authority as his career goes on. Characters that have absolutely contemptible aspects and then nobly heroic aspects, and they seem to live together in David's imagination and in the projection of that imagination in his best work on television in ways that I think are very unusual. An even more dramatic example of that kind of doubleness exists in the character of Swearengen, who, as David has suggested and as I've implied earlier, is a kind of extension of the Bunce character and of the Andy Sipowicz character, but in an even darker hues and even with even darker dimensions to his character than the Dennis Franz figure. And what we're going to pick up here is another sequence from this same astonishing episode of Deadwood, in which the doctor comes to Swearengen, who is kind of the town boss, and is we've seen him commit murders earlier in the show. And the doctor comes to Swearengen about the sick minister that David has mentioned.
Walk in unannounced is a good way to get yourself killed, Doc, especially as the cavalry has us besieged.
I'm here about the minister. He's over at my place. Past my art if I had any. He's damn near blind, mostly paralyzed. Past controlling his functions.
Well, you're preaching to the fucking converted.
I would have seen to him, but I've been fucking busy. Well, he doesn't want to be seen to like that.
What the fuck are we talking about?
A man being cared for and made comfortable till he expires. Girls, you put to the task, deduct your time from my pay.
I get the bag of shit.
You get to care for a human being in his last extremity.
A human being in his last extremity is a bag of shit.
Oh, fuck you, Al!
I'll send someone over to pick him up.
I made Jewel a brace and a boot.
Does it allay the fucking noise she makes when she drags her leg about?
The noise bothers you so much, put cotton in your ears.
Get the fuck out of here, Doc. I'm working on my deployments.
For that which I do, I allow not.
Now that's the minister.
What I would, that I do not.
Get out.
But what I hate, that do I. No. If I would do what I would not, it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me.
Johnny. Shut the door.
If I was a more adaptable primate or one of your regular petitioners, I suspect I wouldn't feel this pain. I guess I'd have a wad of cartilage covering your patella, protecting me from this discomfort. Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ. Just please, God, take that minister. What conceivable godly uses his protracted suffering to you? What conceivable godly use? What conceivable godly use was the screaming of all those men? Did you need to hear their death agonies to know your omnipotence? Mom! Mother, find my arm! Mommy! 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 They shot my leg off! It hurt so bad. It hurt so bad. Admitting my understanding's imperfection. Trusting that you have a purpose. Praying that you consider it served. I beg you to relent. Thy will be done. Amen.
You want to be a road agent? Deal out death when called upon? Make a proper seal. Stop up for breath. Apply pressure, even and firm, like packing a snowball.
Magistrate's here. I got those other two guys waiting upstairs.
Join them. Get this sled for him.
I guess one question that probably occurs is, who's God's instrument in the interruption of the suffering of that man? Swearingen, if the doctor's praying for an intercession, it's Swearingen that intercedes. And, you know, Herman Melville said that any good poem spins against the way it drives. And I think any good scene does that as well. I think all human behavior does that, too. So,
I mean, that there's a counter pressure?
Is Swearingen, Hawthorne said, man's accidents are God's purposes. We miss the good we seek and do the good we little sought. What Swearingen thinks he's doing and what the divine purpose may be in employing him as agent could be two totally different things. And
I could tell from your applause that you could tell these were powerful things, but taking them out of context melodramatizes them in a way that simplifies them. In the context of the full show, it's even more powerful, I think, because you don't, especially in the case of the doctor's breakdown, there's been such preparation for it, you don't feel that it's over the edge at all, because he's always on the edge of a breakdown. But that is the moment when the doctor goes deepest into his memory of the horrors of the Civil War, and it's, of course, an immensely powerful moment. The other thing that strikes me about this scene, David, is the tenderness with which Swearengen commits the mercy killing. Swearengen has committed other murders in the show that the audience has seen, but they've been personal in the same way, haven't they? Yeah. Were you aware of that?
Yeah. And
when Swearengen kills people, he faces them and touches them. He doesn't stand at a distance and shoot.
Unless he's doing business. I mean, there are business murders. But a couple of things that... just in terms of when you actually... I regard Deadwood as a single large episode, and, so we'll be finishing it next year, and then there'll be, 48 of them, and I think then the full pattern of and the full intention of it might come clear. But a couple of things to remember just biographically is that the minister has become, because he has a tumor, has become epileptic. And Swearengen had an epileptic brother who, when they were children, when the brother would fall in seizure, Swearengen would encourage people to come around and throw coins as if the brother's seizure were an entertainment. And the last thing that Swearengen says to the minister is, "You can go now, brother." In terms of the theme of the future continually redefining the meaning of the past and providing an opportunity in some occasions to redeem it, I would think that one perspective in which to regard that scene is that one. The other thing to say is that when the minister comes, Swearengen comes in, the minister is... quoting from various of Paul's epistles to the Corinthians and Romans. And I mentioned in a class earlier this afternoon, this show was originally proposed as set in Rome at the time of Nero, and the first about city cops in Rome at the time of Nero, and the first guy they arrested was St. Paul. And after I had proposed it to HBO, and I had spent a good deal of time thinking it through, and it's like the joke about the pretentious Jewish family that wants to have their kid bar mitzvahed in a place that no other Jewish kid has ever been bar mitzvahed, so they go over to Kenya and they're on a bunch of elephants, and all of a sudden the procession has to stop, and they ask the guide what's going on. He says, "There's another bar mitzvah ahead of us." After I'd pitched this whole series to HBO, they said, "Well, we're doing a show about Rome." And so I reconceived it set in the West. But I was pretty discouraged, and this was a real guy. Henry Wesson Smith was the minister. And
A person who really was in Deadwood that you covered as part of your research.
So was Al Swearengen. Was a real guy. Excuse me. No, the doctor was a sort of necessary postulate. But when they found Reverend Smith dead, he had a sermon that he had intended to preach that afternoon. He was walking from Deadwood to Leeds. And the sermon was, "Upon whose life shall we base our own, but upon that of the great sinner Paul?" And I was interested in the genesis of faith, and Paul, was responsible for the murder of the first of the martyrs, of Saint Stephen, and then had a conversion, which was a result of, according to what most people think now, he was a temporal lobe epileptic.
And he had a seizure on the way to Damascus and had a vision, which was a conversion experience. And temporal lobe epilepsy is characterized in the medical books as, in the aftermath, one gets religious visions, one becomes hypergraphic, you can't stop writing, hence all the epistles, hence the New Testament. And so in the characterization of the minister, I gave him a brain tumor of the same sort that St. Paul had had. And the point that I would make in the context of Professor Thorburn's question is that the experiences of one's own life and nothing is ever lost. When they say man's accidents are God's purposes, you know, to do the show in Deadwood, because the future has reinterpreted that incident in such a way that it was a constructive one for me. And so I try not to spend too much time going over the past, either historically or my own, except to regard it as a positive opportunity. And so I would urge upon you, I get a little embarrassed, you know, when I talk about the lived facts of my own experience. I would urge you to understand that in the deepest part of my heart, I regard those experiences with joy and gratitude and certainly love for my dad.
The tape that's in there actually I'm tempted to play it, but I will not. But I want to talk about it briefly because a nice coda to what we've been talking about would be for you to see what is the concluding scene of this harrowing episode from which you've seen just tiny excerpts. And there's even more horrible violence earlier in the episode. So I mean, it's a very, very disturbing episode, but it's shot through with these intimations of spirit that we hear in David's discourse as well.
I'd be grateful if you'd show the end of it.
You mean the dance?
Yeah.
Okay. I want you to. In fact, you're going to see two sequences. One when Swearengen returns the body to the doctor, and then the final sequence of the episode. And the reason I'm describing this to you is that it's important to realize that the final scene you'll see here is also the final scene of the episode itself.
And of the season.
And of the season, right. It's the season finale. I think the problem is this little light here. Can we shut this light off?
Yeah,
can we shut it off while this is on and put it back on?
We can live with it.
How about if I put this over it? No, it'll burn up my briefcase.
Obscured,
I'm afraid it'll burn my jacket off. I think it's the lights, people. I'm sorry. I apologize for the bad quality of the reproduction. I think it's the lights in the room, but Bartos Theater has other problems. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Where's that? One of your fucking hairs.
He says that's your competition, identifying Swearengen to God as his competition. Or is that one of your heresies?
Let me help you bring him inside.
You're a wily cocksucker, huh? Wait until I got him off the sled, huh?
Throw him.
Let him lay in state, but I need the room for my horse.
Thanks for seeing him through.
Are you going to probe in his noggin now to see what went amiss?
No, not tonight. Tonight I plan to drink in.
Announcing your plans. It's a good way to hear God laugh.
Hi, Doc.
How you doing?
No step to this.
Let me see you move around a bit.
He'll give you a shot.
How do I look?
How do you feel? It's a goddamn question.
I feel good.
Well,
good.
Hey, Doc, give me a whirl.
No, no.
Come on, I'll teach you how.
No, I'm not.
I'm as nimble as a forest creature.
You're as nimble as a forest creature.
No, say it about yourself.
I'm as nimble as a forest creature.
Have the house lights, please. I really do apologize for the bad reproduction. I mean, of course, if you've seen it on TV, you know how clear and magnificent those scenes are. Do you want to make some final comments, or did you just want people to see it?
I'd just like to think of my old man having that last meal.
Say again, David?
I'd just like to think of my old man having that last whirl.
Having that last dance?
Yeah.
So you actually are thinking of your father when you're writing this character?
Well, some ways,
every
yeah.
Second, but.
You know, the reason that he was so involved with, in his professional identity, he was enormously gifted, and also had access to a compassion which did not come to him so easily in his private life. And even now, he's been gone for 25 years. I'll still have people come up to me and say, "Are you the son of the doctor in Buffalo?" And then they'll tell me a story about, I had a girl come up to me at 20th Century Fox just a year or so ago who had had a tumor removed from her stomach, and she was like 11 or 12 years old. And she said, "Your dad, the day I was supposed to be released," now surgeons in those days didn't spend much time with their patients, "he came in and he sat down with me and he said, 'Now, you're going to have this mark here on your belly, but I want you to remember, you're a beautiful, beautiful girl. And anybody who doesn't like that mark on your belly is just saving you time, because he's a jerk.'" And she said it meant something to her for years and years and years afterwards. And I'll tell you one other story about someone with cerebral palsy that character's based on. There was a salesman who used to eat in this greasy spoon across the street from a hospital where my dad was working. And this guy came in, it was a Bible salesman, and he had cerebral palsy. My dad had taken care of him. And I was so struck by, because he couldn't talk at all, and he was shaking and everything. And he came over, and my dad introduced him to us, and he insisted that we shake that we not make anything of his difficulty. And then afterwards, the salesman was sitting up at the counter, and he sent Cokes over for me and my brother. And I said to my dad, "You know, you can't let him pay for that. He's a salesman on the road." And my dad said, "You let him pay for it." Understanding, you know, how to give the person dignity. So, you know, we get all different lessons.
One of the most distinctive aspects of Deadwood, even for cable television, is the immense amount of profanity it contains. And David has talked eloquently about this in the past, but I think it's a subject of great importance in the economy of the show and in the feel you have for the for the characters in the show. So I want us to address that question, but I thought that one way to do it would be to do it through a clip. And I have actually two clips here, and my hope is that I want to give you a sort of another sort of feeling for other aspects of the show, and then have David comment. And let me the first scene. These are disparate, separate scenes from different moments in Deadwood. The first scene is an astonishingly powerful scene at the poker table, where we see Wild Bill Hickok in a poker game with the man who will ultimately kill him. And it's a very powerful scene for reasons I think you'll see. And I'm just going to let it run. And then what follows after that is maybe the single most astonishing and weird scene in all of Deadwood, in which a character who virtually speaks no English, has only one word of English that he uses in this scene, comes up and talks to Swearengen. And I have that scene as well. Some of you I know what scene it is. And if you feel uneasy about bad language, stuff your ears with cotton.
Even the machine rebels at the unrelenting profanity.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Stop where the fuck you are, Mr. Wood.
Swidgen.
Oh, this is the
yeah.
scene.
Well,
we're starting from
Swidgen.
So one thing you won't
you
see.
You gotta walk the fuck out and then come around the back.
Swidgen.
Nope. Close the door, Bob. Click later. We got a situation here, Al. Come in the front fucking door.
Bring him up.
You want me to take him out and bring him around back?
Bring him the fuck up.
Come on, Mr. Wu. Come on.
Put him in a chair and get out, Johnny.
Sit. Sit! He won't sit.
Get out.
Yes, sir.
What is it, Wu?
Tong Yun. Zhak Zai.
Do you think I should open it back up?
I believe that's what Al would want.
Morning, he has to lick it, and then he leaves.
Mayor?
August commencement to my administration. Stand stymied outside a saloon beside a degenerate titlicker.
Now, this is one of you, huh?
Oh, Tong Yun. Tong Yun. Stop.
Oh, this is him dead. And these two.
Ba Guai Loni. Cocksucker.
Yeah, glad I taught you that fucking word. These are whites, huh?
White cocksucker.
Two white cocksuckers killed him and stole the dope that he was bringing to you.
White cocksucker. You, Swidgen.
The dope that you were gonna fucking sell to me?
White cocksucker.
These two white cocksuckers? Who the fuck did it?
Who?
Who, you ignorant fucking chink?
Who?
Who? Who? Who stole the fucking dope?
Cocksucker!
Oh,
those are the first cocksuckers I have ever heard shouted from that room, Dan, that didn't come from Al's mouth. It wasn't followed by Al.
Coming over to that railing, pointing at you,
and beckoning up them stairs with your fucking knife.
Listen. I find cocksuckers. I find dope and cocksuckers who steal fucking dope.
Huh? Cocksucker.
Oh, yeah. I'll find those fucking cocksuckers. Get the fuck out of here, Wu, the back way, you understand? The back way. I'm gonna start getting people having the wrong fucking idea of things around here.
All right, do it now. David, wait, he's gonna... The second scene, the other scene is gonna play... I reversed the order of the scenes because I forgot that I had queued it up to this, but we're gonna play the poker playing scene too, and then David will respond. And then after he talks about that, we'll open to questions from the audience. Is it a slow rewind? Is that the problem? The high tech.
Don't get me started.
The high tech media lab.
The whole metaphysics of the slow rewind.
Are we ready? Even my gas powered TV rewinds faster.
I raise 100.
Back 100.
That man's overplaying his hand. Whatever the fuck I got left.
420, back to you.
As advertised. You got more nerve than sense, huh, Bill?
What have you got?
Man stays on fours. They call this a game of skill? Well, you gutted me, didn't you, Bill, you son of a bitch?
You were told about that talk. Go eat, Jack.
All right. I thank you for that kindness. You just bought yourself something with that.
Some boys can't go near a cliff without jumping off.
One
of the versions of the murder of Hickok was that it wasn't that he had beaten McCall in poker, but that he gave him the dollar afterwards. That McCall couldn't abide the gesture of compassion, and that's why he killed him.
Language, Dave.
Yeah, let me just take a minute to express appreciation for the great sensitivity that you've shown in the selection of these clips, and I'm very grateful for that. The obscenity in Deadwood is, as I mentioned, I was interested in trying to identify what principles of organization operate in a society in which law does not exist. And because Deadwood was a criminal community, it was on land which had just been ceded to the Indians, and they didn't want to pass any laws, because if they passed laws, that would mean that their claims could be overturned. So they were just trying to steal everything without having any laws at all. It was sort of a laboratory environment in which one then tries to identify what principles of governance develop. Language, it seemed to me, had to serve two functions. The first was to beat down the viewer's pre-existing expectation that any law would be obeyed. That is,
every sentence is so soaked with obscenity as to bleach out the expectation that any civility can be expected to govern in any scene. Therefore, how do you live in such an emotional environment as a viewer? So that was the first part of it. Then I wanted to show how words generated meaning, not because of any intrinsic quality, but because of the context of emotional association in which they were expressed. Swearingen's, the reason that I took a moment to express my thanks to Professor Thorburn is that in his choice of scenes, he demonstrated a kind of emotional connection to the materials, which helped me to understand my own intentions. That's how, in a conversation in which, let's say, Professor Thorburn is Swearingen and I'm Wu, one word, given enough emotional communication, can bear the weight of an entire exchange of a whole story can be told with one word if the emotions in the context are adequately rendered. And in the development of the relationship between Swearingen and Wu, what I wanted to show was, despite all of the prejudices that existed about Asians and, by extension, other minorities, how a kind of order could generate itself, which was, if not humane, at least humanizing as a contrary impulse.
We're going to turn to questions from the audience in a second, so formulate your questions, and we're going to remind you that we are audio taping and videotaping this, so identify yourself, unless you want to remain anonymous, when you come to these microphones. Begin to formulate your questions. I'll start, but I hope people will start coming to the mics. One question, David, I have two, a question and a half. The half question is to make you continue a little bit more on the question of the profanity in the show. I remember reading something, maybe it was in Mark Singer's piece in The New Yorker about you, but maybe it was elsewhere. But in some piece I read about your dealings with HBO, I recall your actually having been asked by HBO to justify the dirty language.
Yeah.
Did you write a paper or some sort of report?
Well, the
HBO was worried about
this. Yeah. In fact, the guardians of the Western, of the classical movie Westerns, were very much offended by the obscenity in Deadwood and asked me to make the case to prove that there had been such obscenity as opposed to the language which obtained in the Westerns of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And a couple of things to say about that. The language which obtained in those Westerns had nothing to do with the way people spoke in the West in the 1870s and everything to do with the exigencies of the Jewish immigrants who ran Hollywood, who wanted to send a message that they weren't going to rock the boat in terms of the stories that they were telling. And there had been a period of 5 or 10 years in the late teens and early 20s where films had gotten a little racy. And what the Goldwyns and the Laskys and the Louis B. Mayers, and you can finish, the Xanax, got together and hired a front Gentile named Hayes, who instituted what was called the Hayes Production Code, which proclaimed that obscenity in word, thought, or deed was an offense not only against the laws of man, but against divine law, and would not be tolerated in their films, which was a way of saying, we ain't going to rock the boat. Now, if you're an artist, when you're confronted with those kind of strictures, you can refuse to participate, or you can try and find a way to internalize those strictures such that it does not distort the story you're trying to tell. and the great storytellers in films of the 30s and 40s extrapolated a character who was very laconic. Not only didn't use swear words, he just didn't talk much at all. And whose stoicism invoked a set of values, which, now, when we see a great work of art, we bind to that work of art, having to do with, if we're children when we see it, that's a fundamental imaginative reality, which we are not going to see changed. So instead of saying, I like Shane, what we say is, that's not the way they talked in 1870. That ain't my problem. But it became my problem because it was HBO's problem, and so I did the research. The best secondary witness is Mencken in a book called The American Language, and I'm sure you know Dan Boorstin. You knew,
yes,
Dan,
sure.
Boorstin, who wrote about what it was that when the Westering impulse, to the extent that it was a that, you know, if you went out to an environment like this, it wasn't because you were doing great in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. You know, there was there were some personality attributes usually. Maybe there was a warrant or two out for you. And the other thing to remember is these weren't farming communities. The mining law said that you owned a claim only as long as you were on it and working it. And if you've left for 3 days, whoever came could take it from you. So you had to be willing to resort to violence. And in the same way that apes, so that they don't have to be fighting all the time, develop, you know, this kind of stuff, obscenity was used as a way of announcing, don't come in here with any weak stuff. You know, if you're going to... And the rest of it was, because there were no laws at all, any question was potentially had lethal implications. If I say to you, where are you from? You're usually going to say, you know, I'm from wherever I'm from. In Deadwood, if you say, where are you from? The guy says, what the fuck is that to you? So that immediately it becomes a potentially mortal situation. Because he doesn't know if you're out there with a warrant for his arrest or so. That combination, it seemed to me, all of which worked to create the kind of extremity of language. And what I wanted to do, as I say, after establishing that premise, to then show how language came to complicate itself as one of the alternatives to statute in terms of how people govern their behavior.
Now, you see, rich and remarkable as that is, and compelling in a way as that is, there's still a lot about the language of Deadwood you haven't discussed, David, and I want to ask you about another aspect,
sure,
of it. I've often thought that one of the things that doubles the profanity is the almost Shakespearean grandiloquence of some of the characters. I'm thinking especially of that sleazy mayor,
yeah,
who goes around, sometimes he actually delivers soliloquies, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And also the level of his language is virtual. He sounds often like a kind of Victorian preacher, and his vocabulary is immensely large. I'm wondering about, now it's obvious that you're aware of this,
sure,
distinction. What effects do you hope is created?
Well, one thing to remember is this was Victorian times, and to the extent that people had book learning, the book learning they had to do with Victorian literature and the Bible and Shakespeare. You know, there's a wonderful story about Kit Carson riding 7 days to get his new collection of Sir Walter Scott. And so it seemed to me in that regard that those people who and it wasn't so much that they had been to school, that they were autodidacts. They were self-taught, and the reason and people in that environment who had recourse to books were highly, highly motivated. It was an alternative state of being for them, which stood in contrast to the way they were living their lives. So it seemed to me to be credible at that level. that people who had recourse to that sort of rhetoric, you know, went for the gusto in terms of the what Professor Thorburn talks about, is the grandiloquence of some of their speech. But it seemed to me also that as a work generates its own reality, in the same way that Wu's language, that Wu's single English word in English that he knows, came to because of the complication of the emotional transaction, became enriched in the viewer's understanding by tonalities and rhythms, that I feel that the metrics of speech are important and representative, even in those of us who feel mistakenly, as I believe, that we are separate from each other as individuals. It seems to me that the way God says, I too have a hand here, is in the rhythms and metrics of speech. So that even unbeknownst to themselves, they honor a divine presence in certain of the locutions of Deadwood.
I don't want you to feel anxiety, because I have plenty of things to ask David about. So if you're happy with this, don't worry about it. But if you do have questions, please, sir, come up to the microphone.
Please, come forward, sir. I feel like Benny Hinn.
Right there. Okay.
Hi. I'm DeWitt Henry from Emerson College, and we have some mutual friends over our writing lives. My question,
I'm
actually
afraid even to think what that means.
Well, Richard Yates was one.
Oh, really? Oh, sure. I know who you. Yes, of course.
I guess it's a writer's question. Given the scope of a series like Deadwood, at least to an outsider, it has the intensity of a Victorian novel. And I'm wondering exactly how you are the auteur, how you manage to subcontract various episodes to outside writers. How you initiate them? Do you give them treatments? Are there storyboards that they're filling in, or can they really take an improvisational role in directing the direction of the story?
I believe that all storytelling is collaborative in one way or another, and nobody writes an episode independent or goes off and writes an episode. All the writers are in a room all the time, in one room. And so every scene is generated in that one horrible, stinking trailer, which is just 50 yards from the set. And, you know, once the scene is generated, we don't let it ripen particularly. Usually the scene is written either the day that it's shot or the day before it's shot. And there are no scripts, you know, there's no finished script before the shooting begins. If the shoot is an average of 12 days, the script is finished on the 12th day of the shoot. And so that's the idea of being an auteur. You know, I don't believe in any of that shit, of any of that stuff anyway. You know, I don't care whose name is.
Yeah, you're not on the set now. What's your language?
Yes, forgive me. I just don't care about that.
This gives us an excuse, David, to talk a little bit about something I'd mentioned to you I wanted to ask you about. And again, I think I'm cribbing here from, there was a brilliant maybe overly loving portrait of David in the New Yorker recently by a guy who was a Yale friend of his, and I don't know.
That had never. Now wait a second. I'd never met that guy. Not only that, but he said I'd
not
dyed
only
my
met,
hair.
He had met him, but the guy had sat at David's feet at Yale. I mean, David didn't remember him. That's what.
Oh, know. That was well. I was loaded.
No, David taught courses there. But in fact, in the piece, he talks about how intimidating, even though David was only a few years older than he, and he was like an undergraduate, how intimidating David was to the other undergraduate. It's a wonderful piece, and the guy who wrote it is a wonderful writer. His name is Mark Singer. And it's a very good piece of writing in its own way, and it gets deeply into aspects of David's vision of life, and is certainly worth reading. One of the things that he says in that piece, he describes David's methods of writing, and they are astonishing and in many ways very strange. maybe you could tell our audience about how you write an episode of Deadwood, how you settle in front of that
screen. Yeah, well, I try, I don't think about writing when I'm not writing. And I won't plan a scene before I write it. That has to do with... I would hasten to add that, you know, the chemist Kekule, I think I tell the story in that piece about, you know, the guy who figured out the structure of the benzene ring, and he'd worked on it for 20 years, and then he had a dream. He saw a snake swallowing its tail. He said, that's it. That's the structure of the benzene ring. So the next day they said to him, you know, not bad. You go to sleep, you wake up, you got the patent on the benzene ring. He said, visions come to prepared spirits. And so that what I would propose is, you know, I spent years and years and years. I remember I spent one useful period of 15 months writing the same 12 pages word for word every morning. Word for word. Because... you know, my wiring is a little iffy. And so having now come to a point in my life where I feel that at one level, you know, I was getting ready to be able to work this way through all the period of time when I worked a different way. But now I don't plan the episodes, I don't plan the scenes, and yet I feel that these characters are, you've heard me say a few times, probably until some of you want to gouge your eyes out like they're grapes, that I believe that our sense of ourselves as separate from each other is an illusion. And in fact, that we are organs of some larger organism which knows us, although we do not know it. And if that is the case, I regard myself as a vessel of whatever that larger organism is, rather, or its instrument, rather than as the source of the scenes. So a lot of what I do is try to get out of the way. And that's the way I work on my writing, that's the way I work with the actors, that's the way I edit, I find that it puts me in the path of an enormous amount of energy. As I say, you know, 15 months for 12 pages is what some might define as a meager output. But I do, you know, I've done 350 hours of episodes over the past decade or so, and more recently, you know, this is high. This is work which is as good as I can do, no matter how long I spend on it. And I think that has to do, to some extent, with a readying of the spirit in humility to receive rather than to regard myself as the as generating it.
Look, Carrie, some of the details are interesting, David. I mean, in the New Yorker piece, Singer describes how you will go down and sit in front of a monitor, and someone is typing, and you don't write. You don't actually do the writing.
No, because you
do it through talking, right?
I'm an obsessive compulsive, so if I can put my hands on anything, we're all in trouble. So, you know, I have no phone, I have no watch, I don't know how to use a computer, because if I even use a pencil, you know, come back and see me in 3 months. I'll be hanging upside down in gravity boots, you know. Because I think that when you're, you know, the brain is very plastic, which is to say very malleable when you're very young. And I think if it gets shaken in certain ways, you're predisposed to certain neural incapacities, and you fall into repetitive patterns of behavior. It's called repetition compulsion. It's called a lot of things. Anyways, I find that I function most effectively when I sort of disembody myself. So I just lie there and I talk, and the words come up on the screen. And then I fix the words, but I never actually lay my hands on anything. And it certainly helped to diminish my pharmacological obligations.
Yeah. Listening to David for a while, I realized that he has a kind of a repertoire of ways of describing these pharmacological
being out of my mind.
That are witty, but also unsettling, and something of the way the show is. Another question that I've always had about Deadwood, and it's become much more intense as I've watched recent episodes, David, is the time frame. Sometimes it seems as if a second episode, the new episode, begins 1 minute after the previous episode. Is that true of it? Do you think of it as every episode like that?
No, but some episodes. But if it happens that way. That's the way it happens. You know, sometimes a day will go by. I originally intended that each season would be 1 year in the life of the camp. The camp was destroyed at the end of 4 years. But I do try to let the materials... The one thing I knew, for example, at the end of this season that we just finished shooting last week, was it culminated with the elections. And these are 90% of these are true stories. And Bullock was defeated in the election because George Hearst, the father of William Randolph Hearst, fixed the election, and Bullock was so pissed off he barricaded himself in the office and wouldn't leave, wouldn't turn over the badge to the idiot who had defeated him.
This is an unaired episode?
These are unaired episodes. And so the one thing I knew at the end of the third season, which we just finished shooting, which will go on in June, was that was the concluding sequence. Never got to it. You know, the season was over. I never got to that scene. Which caused a few raised eyebrows in all the ad campaigns and everything, which were based on that culminating sequence. Because I had sold... It seemed to me that the great moment in American history was after we'd won the Revolutionary War, when everyone wanted to make Washington the king, and the Continental Congress was a bunch of slugs and corrupt, you know, hacks, and Washington went and knelt and presented his sword to the Continental Congress, saying that it would be a government of laws and not of men. And Swearingen went and persuaded Bullock, even though it had been a corrupt election, to go ahead and acknowledge the defeat, so that the loyalty would no longer be to Bullock, but to the democratic process. And I really wanted to finish this season with that story, but we just didn't get there. So we're going to open next season with that story.
When you say you didn't get there, David, does that mean because as the actual act of writing scene by scene occurred, you made greater discoveries, and
each scene exists in terms of its internal dynamics, and then it exists in connection with each scene is becomes as if it were a character in conversation with another character, which is the other scene, which precedes it, and so on. And your first loyalty has to be to the thing which already lives. You know, what Swearingen says, if you want to hear God laugh, tell him your plans. My plan was to have Bullock but that isn't where the characters were going. So Bullock led the inauguration parade for Teddy Roosevelt. Bullock wound up Teddy Roosevelt's best friend.
See, he's talking about the historical Bullock. Picked up on that.
The historical set.
Not the character.
But this election was a real election that the real George Hearst fixed. And to the extent that Teddy Roosevelt was the first political figure who reined in the pure capitalists, the robber barons, it seemed to me crucial to render the dynamic between Bullock and George Hearst, and so that's the part that took longer, and so that there went the election.
David, I'm Aaron from the Huge fan.
Thank you.
First of all, I just want to say, I don't know if it sounds pretentious, but thank you so much for Deadwood. It's just unbelievable. So I have a chance to ask you a question. My head is swarming, so I'm going to put aside the desire to be self-seeking and ask you about the PA. I've heard you help out PAs. Who, myself being a writer and an aspiring filmmaker and recovering addict. So I'm going to put aside that urge. So that never happened.
He just put it aside.
It's gone. It's off the table. I'm wondering. I guess the first question that was addressed to storytelling. I'm wondering how you are you essentially the director? If you could explain the process of directing Deadwood with the actors, and because there's some of the most phenomenal performances I've ever seen, particularly the guy, you know, Swearingen, I forget the actor's name.
Ian McShane.
Ian McShane, yeah. And I'm just wondering if you could explain how
who I had written that part for? Eddie O'Neill from Married with Children.
He'd be good in that.
And they wouldn't cast him because it ain't television, it's HBO.
But they did better. They got a great actor.
Well, and then we cast Powers Booth, and Powers got sick. And I told him if he got well, I'd write a different part for him, but we had to go ahead and shoot. And so then we came to Ian, and I said, Ian is wonderful. But anyway, the way that, titles don't really mean too much to me. Mine or anybody else's. And so we all, you know, after a scene's been written, I come down on the set and we walk through it. And I have my say, and the director has his say, and so on, and the actors do. And I don't mean to suggest it's a democracy. It isn't. But I try to answer to a higher kind of principle, which is to be respectful and of you know, what other people are feeling or other people's incapacities. You know, sometimes an actor doesn't do well with a particular kind of scene, and I'll change the scene on the spot, or I'll see something. And that's one of the upsides of working the way we do, is that everybody's prepared to change anything, you know, all the way, even in editing. You know, I'll take a scene, I'll take the end of the scene and put it at the beginning of the scene and all that stuff.
It take a long time to establish that type of mood on set, just to begin at the very beginning of the process?
No, well, Walter Hill was the first director, and Walter's done a lot of films, and as he said, we parted very amiably, but he said there's only room for one king of the castle. And I don't think of myself that way, but he did. He thought of himself that way, but you know, I thought he did a wonderful job.
But David, it is true that your involvement with Deadwood is much more intense than a typical writer's would be.
Oh yeah,
you know, you're on the set every
day. And
talk to the actors all the time.
HBO insists on that because there's no script. So, you know, they say, well, that's true. You know, you better be down there because the actors have no chance to prepare the scene. You know, the director has no chance to visualize the scene. So, you know, there you go.
Kevin.
My name is Kevin Riegel. I'm in Professor Thorburn's television class.
Hi, Kevin.
That
was me, Kevin. So.
Okay. You talked earlier about some of the decisions, this was actually in class, I guess, about some of the decisions that went into deciding into the genesis of Deadwood, but I'm curious why you decided to set it in the American West. I mean, there aren't any other Westerns on television today, and haven't had a particularly strong go of it in the movies recently. I'm wondering what drew you to that.
Well, I would say a couple of things about that. That's a nasty piece of gum on the bottom of my shoe. But I'm very proud that I got my shoe shine in LaGuardia Airport today. All that stuff, you know, at the racetrack where I have been occasionally abducted and forced to spend large amounts of time, there's an expression about the smart money. And that the smart money usually misses its bus in the morning. And the application of that is that, you know, in terms of what kind of series is in vogue at a given time, that's nonsense. You know, when a given form, say the Western, is completely out of vogue, what that means is that it's the opportunity exists for a revisiting from a different point of view. So I never worry. You know, the one thing everybody knew when NYPD Blue went on the air was the attention span of the audience had been infantilized by MTV. Everybody hated cops, you know, no shot. So I don't worry about that. But the other thing is that I was interested in particular in Deadwood because it was a criminal enterprise. It acknowledged itself as a criminal enterprise. When Wild Bill Hickok was killed, they acquitted the guy because they didn't want to be taken for having recognized any kind of law. Because if they recognized one kind of law, then what someone would have had the right to say is, you just stole all this from the Indians.
That's very interesting. My name is Sajan. I'm a postdoc. And my question was, you were talking about the rehearsal process. And I was curious about, over the course of NYPD Blue, Deadwood, I guess, germinates in your head, and or this Roman version of it.
Yeah.
So what I'm sort of really curious to know is, as you kind of revisit the character sort of on a weekly episode basis, does Swearengen really emanate in origins from Sipowicz? If he does, I mean, he's a darker version. So I guess in your heart, did you kind of leave NYPD Blue at some point, and when did that maybe happen? And when did all of a sudden you find yourself thinking more and more about Deadwood and less about what you were getting paid to?
Yeah, I'm not a good witness about that stuff, about my own, you know, biography in that regard, or creative biography. The big thing for me was I was loaded when I was doing NYPD Blue, and I got sober, and I think that accounts for a lot of the changes. Swearengen was a real guy. How about this? Swearengen was a twin. How'd you like to meet his twin? I think that there's a kind of flux. You know, there's my own experience, but there's also, you know, everything that I read, and I read all the time, every day, you know, and characters will come alive in my mind, and you know, and then they exist independently, and then experiences of mine or past characters I've worked on might get drawn into their orbit, and it doesn't do to, in some class, oh, I guess I was teaching this morning at Columbia. We didn't talk about Zeno's paradox in your class, did we?
No.
You know, the idea that in a purely logical form, you know, the hare never catches the tortoise. If he keeps closing it by half, and yet all of Einstein's, you know, theorems are based on that kind of mathematical logic, and which is to say that I believe that subject and object, which is the basis of Zeno's paradox, is an illusion, and that in fact what was subject is constantly becoming object and going so. To separate me as a discrete entity, and what was I working on, and how did it germinate and stuff, is to fail to recognize that I am just sort of a way station for all kinds of influences that come in and out, and thankfully Vicodin has been eliminated in that.
It's very helpful, David.
Thank you, sir.
Yes.
Good evening. My name is Robin Comedy.
Robin.
Hi. I wanted to thank you for Sipowicz.
You're welcome.
I wanted to thank you also for Deadwood. My heart's in Deadwood. We have a person in common out there, Mary Kopko.
Oh, sure. Mary Kopko's a Deadwood librarian who's been so helpful to us.
She's wonderful. I had a bunch of questions, but I didn't, like this gentleman over here, my head's spinning as well because I don't know which to pick first.
Let me ask you a question. Do you ever get out to Los Angeles?
Not yet.
Well, you should come out and be an extra on the show. We'll make you a dance hall girl. And because, you know, Mary was. Mary came out.
That would be my dream. Yes, I do know.
And we will, and we'll, and you can ask me all the questions you want.
Could I have
a note? Why don't you ask one question?
Ask one now.
One question.
Yep.
Okay, I suppose, where did Walcott come from? And if I may, give you an invitation. I'm a future Deadwood resident. I have a mineral claim right down the road from Friendship Monument.
Atta girl.
And if you ever need a other backdrop with nothing in the way, it would be my honor.
Okay. All right. Walcott, thank you so much. Oh, look at that. Walcott was George Hearst's geologist. And I wanted to present a kind of forerunner or an avatar of George Hearst, who embodied the principles of capitalism, and to show that the rapacity and voracity, V-O-R-A, of the capitalist process had a sexual predicate. And so I wanted to have a serial killer who was also a geologist, as the precursor in the second season to Hearst, who would appear in the third season. And then it seemed to me that the guy who had played the first murderer, the murderer of the first hero, Wild Bill Hickok, could also play the geologist. Were you? Uh-huh. Good for you.
So in your mind, it was significant that the same actor played the two roles?
I just felt like it
was
wasn't wrong.
It was hard to recognize him at first.
Yeah.
But it does come as a shock if you're watching the show to make that recognition. It's an unusual decision because usually you would think it violates the sort of fictional autonomy of the world to have a dead person come alive.
Yeah. And you'll recall, however, that I did that with Bunce, you know, with Sal Benedetto. And it seems to me that you can't be too cavalier about it, but there was something in the soul of Jack McCall, I think, which survived his decease and which reincarnated itself in an impulse. You know, George Hearst says, "I am the boy the earth talks to." He believed that the earth spoke to him. And that particular kind of demonic, kind of messianic narcissism, I think is often shared by assassins and the extremely wealthy. So,
question here.
Hi, David.
Hi, Paul.
Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you, sir.
I work actually in Cambridge, working for a newspaper that it's a homeless newspaper where a lot of homeless people can contribute writing, and a lot of times I encounter a lot of writing by people who are mentally divergent, you know, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
I don't like to necessarily hear mental illness, all that. But my question for you is, through your years of, you know, self-confessed madness and subsequent drug abuse, did you have any moments of clarity where, I don't know, where maybe even in the midst of the drugs and your mind's going out of control, where all of a sudden you could sort of see yourself clearly or anything like that that really helped bring your writing to, I don't know,
to light? I don't know about the last part, about it's helping to bring my... I remember once I turned out to be burying myself in Mexico. And that got my attention. I was working for these criminals, I suppose, would be the fair way to put it. And we were manufacturing stuff, and the I had gotten involved with them, as these things usually occur, by steps. And I'd sold my passport to them about 6 months before and told myself, and that's as far as I go. So 6 months later, I'm down in Mexico doing the rest of this stuff. And there's a chemist down there, this lunatic chemist with, he was from Central Casting, you know, with these bottle glasses. And he'd get in a car and he'd have an accident like within 200 feet. he would hit a burrow or something and start throwing pesos everywhere. And so he contracted a bit of a stomach ache, and he had a consort named Yum Yum who decided to treat his tummy ache with an enema.
Are you sure this isn't an episode that you're describing?
Well, it was an episode. Anyways, as it turned out, he had peritonitis, and she killed him with this enema. And we were all down there illegally, and so I'm out there digging this guy's grave and in our finca there outside Cuernavaca, and toss the body. And, you know, now I figure, well, let me see if I can get some ID in case at some point I try to do the right thing, you know, and contact his relatives, let him know the news of his finish, because we were all down there, you know. And it was me. He had my passport that I had sold 6 months before that they had used, you know. And only the most liberal applications of chloroform kept that moment of clarity from extending into a protracted bout of lucidity and perhaps a life change. But that's why they make chloroform, and I was able to keep going for a number of...
Over here.
Erin Pantea, MIT alum and playwright.
Hi, Erin.
You've clearly done a whole lot of historical research for Deadwood, and there's a whole set of various truths, which some of them contradict. How do you reconcile that with the very different truth that you're working with in the world of Deadwood?
Give me a for instance.
For instance, you've talked about several characters. The Doctor, who is a plausible construction from... But yeah. He didn't exist, and yet he's interacting with all
a
of these people.
A necessary postulate.
Yeah. I guess what I was saying was that there were doctors out there. But there were... The Civil War was really the formative experience for any physician during that period. And so I've never consciously gone against what I took to be an historical truth. In fact, there have been certain historical truths which I decided had to be bullshit. And so I tried to tell the story of why I thought, for example, when Wild Bill Hickok was killed, everyone says, well, he had the dead man's hand, you know, aces over eights. And every time I would read that, I would think, who the hell noticed what his hand was if he just had his head blown off? I mean, I would think you'd probably be saying, come on, feats, don't fail me now, you know? And so in my subsequent research, there was a Captain Massey who toured, who kept in his wrist the bullet fragment, who had been playing at the table, and kept the bullet fragment in his wrist. So now I'm thinking, well, so I'm Captain Massey, I'm touring, I need a little embellishment, you know, besides here's the bullet in my wrist. So I say, and do you know that what the hand was that he was holding? And it just gives my story a little. So I did that story of how Captain Massey came to make up what has come to be taken as an historical fact. But I try not to do the other thing, which is encountering some fact which I believe to be true, I try never to contradict that. But I do take the license of, if we don't know, I try to, for example, Calamity Jane, I always nourished a suspicion didn't look like Doris Day. So... you know, I did my research and I figured out, I decided that was what she was like, the way she's portrayed. But forgive me if am I encountering the question you're trying to put, or
that is the question. But if I'm remembering correctly, which I may not be, in the first episode you changed the dates of when everybody arrived in the city, and sort of I'm curious about. I mean, that may be the only place you do something like that, but how you made this decision. I mean, it's more artistic that way. But.
Yeah. The best documentation I could find had Hickok arriving July 30th and Bullock arriving August 2nd of 1876. And I figured, that was okay. There are those who argued that Bullock never met Hickok, but his great nephew named Kellar, I think was the fellow's name, the great nephew, recounted an anecdote that Bullock told about having encountered Hickok. And having said all of that, those kinds of minor reconciliations or elisions or so on, I think so long as, Melville talked about the truth and the very truth. And if I can stay with what I feel as the very truth, I guess I do allow myself that sort of latitude, 48 hours, that kind of thing.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Carry this forward a little bit. I think that was a very interesting question.
Absolutely.
And requires, it could be a thesis. It's a very important matter, the treatment of history in Westerns in general. But David, you may have not given you may have given the impression, at least to members of the audience who don't know the show as well as some of the rest of us, that or don't know the background, that in fact there are only a few connections to historical fact. But in fact, most of the show is grounded in history.
I would say 90%.
I mean, not just Bullock, but the death of the boy happened, right? There was a man named Swearingen, that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. E.B. Farnham was the first mayor, and Merrick, A.W. Merrick, was the first newspaper guy, and Sol Starr was the second mayor and served 10 terms, and Trixie is recorded as having existed and having put one through the guy's head in a collection called Early Pioneer Days in the Black Hills by a writer named McClintock. In the story that he tells, the guy got up and was walking around the following day, and that's one that I disagreed with. So, it's Cleanthe Brooks, for whom both Professor Thorburn and I have a real reverence and gratitude, in trying to educate me a little bit about the different kinds of truths, suggested that the truths of reportage or of history depend upon, to the extent they depend upon anything, a correspondence to an externally verifiable reality. And the truths of storytelling are the truths of an internal emotional coherence. That can quickly become the refuge of a charlatan, but I guess I'd have to plead guilty to that possibility.
Cleanthe Brooks, former professor at Yale, author of, among other great works, anyone know? The Well-Wrought Urn, one of the great books of formalist criticism.
And who found a little something to admire in Professor Thorburn.
Not to mention this guy.
Yeah. Go ahead.
My name's Vic. Hi, Vic.
First, I'd like to say your work is really great.
Thank you.
I think when you said the network, it was hard because networks were very scared of a lot of stuff. I think you and Stan Blaschko worked great together, and you really put some stuff together. Really helped TV Thank see you. What it was, because when cable came around, networks were in trouble anyway. So when you did Deadwood, it surprised them all with stuff that is real and people really like it. They get Emmys, and the network's going, I wonder what this is about, because they can't get it through their heads. They're getting it because it's real, because it's honest, and they don't see that because they're so afraid of the licenses, the viewers, and everything. When you show people's rear ends and things like that. To go so far.
Yeah.
It really
helped. There are rear ends in David's show, too, though.
It helped them see that, people want to see that for some reason. Even Dennis is. But still, it's something real. And I think there's an audience out there for that. They don't like stupid, like when Evan Spelling did the stuff he did, it was basically comic book material. But when you guys came along, it was different. It was supposed to be what it was. And I want to thank you for that, because you really helped TV move along and save them from cable. And, I don't know, whatever.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Welcome. Thank you very much.
We're folks, we're in the what my friend Henry Jenkins calls the lightning round now. We have 8 minutes, so I want to ask our questioners to be succinct, and I want to ask David to be succinct also. Do your best, anyway.
I shall try.
Hi, my name is Aggie.
Hi, Aggie.
I'm not a writer. I'm an engineer, so my question will be somewhat general. As I understand it, your work seems to focus on finding the humanity in characters that are somewhat morally ambiguous. Shall we say, and this can make for very moving and interesting television, but I wonder if you think that there's any downside to it, or to put it another way, do you think some things, and maybe even some people, are merely unforgivable? And if not, can that be a dangerous position to hold? And I think I ask this in part because of the current political climate. And thank you.
Thank you. Are certain people unforgivable? No. I don't think so. I think that that
not even that serial killer in the in your show.
No. No. And that was sort of why I wanted to.
Not even your old fraternity friend, the president.
Not even my old fraternity friend, the president. Especially not him, whom I find to be more of a genial boob than a moral menace. Let me say, and I forgive me for not being brief, but I do want to say something to the writers that I address. Please forgive me, sir. Wait, you ask your question,
well,
no, and then I'm
going to come on. Why don't we let Wally do the last question? So take your time. There's
okay.
Time. There's
okay.
Time. No, finish.
Okay.
And then
I think that the war in Iraq has ever so much more to do with the abdication, with the media's abdication of its moral responsibility, than with the deficiencies of our president. I think that the media have infantilized the expectations of the audience because of the lack of some sort of transcendent informing vision. I believe that the surrogate existence that is provided by television has come to supplant the genuine emotional life of the populace. I believe, therefore, that the reason that I have chosen not to do any more contemporary drama is because the assault on the collective sensibility of 9/11 was such as to make the audience, give the audience so much fear that the only way that they could be placated was with a television series, a mini series, which would be finished in 3 weeks, and which would tell them that you do not have to fear danger here because we are going to take the war over there. And the rationale for that war had nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction and everything to do with the habituation of the viewing public to the shaping of human experience in distorted forms for which the media is responsible. So that the first 3 weeks of the Iraq miniseries was received with enormous public approval, because it was the series that we wanted to see, and it was the triumph of American weaponry, and it had a beginning, a middle, and an end. And the disaffection with the Iraq war has nothing to do with what is going on with the Iraqi people, and everything to do with the fact that that series is over. We don't want to see that series anymore. We wanted to be narcotized in our reaction to the assault on the World Trade Center. We got what we were looking for. Don't be bothering us anymore with the goddamn roadside bombs. Bring the boys home. Well, the boys were never coming home after 3 weeks. War isn't like that. It was a war undertaken for the wrong reasons and responded to for reasons that the public has absolutely no conception about. And therefore, the dialogue that's going on about President Bush has nothing to do with President Bush and everything to do with the fact that he is the failed central character in an infantile drama which was being staged to narcotize the American public. And no matter who was in office, the so-called intelligentsia would be trivializing him and criticizing him now, which is not to say that he's not a moron. I know better than anyone else. I spent a lot of time with him. You know, we're fraternity brothers. But that is not what's happening in society in America today. There is nothing. War is a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. And if you want to know who told the biggest lie in order to get our country into war, it wasn't George Bush. It was one of our great presidents, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who knew that we were going to be attacked at Pearl Harbor and sat on the information because he knew what he had to do to mobilize public opinion. So it's got, and I'm not defending, I'm not criticizing Franklin Roosevelt, I'm not defending George Bush. I am saying that there's a different drama which is enacting itself in our country right now, and it has to do with a failure to acknowledge the necessary moral and imaginative predicate in what has become an entirely virtual existence, which is, you know, people spend more than half their waking hours watching television. Just think about that for a second. They spend more than half their waking hours watching television. That has to shape the neural pathways. It creates an impatience, for example, with irresolution. And I'm doing what I can to tell stories which engage those issues in ways that can engage the imagination so people don't feel threatened by it. That's why I won't do any more contemporary series, because that image is so indelibly imprinted on the American consciousness that we are prepared, let me tell you, for a genocide. All of this bullshit about Iraq, let one more plane go into one more big building and the American public will sign on to the extermination of everyone of the Muslim faith. Trust me.
I hope you're wrong about that.
Oh, I hope I'm wrong too, Molly, but it'll happen like that.
Do you remember your question?
Yeah, except at this point I feel irritated.
No, that's all right.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
This, my name's
so we're
Wally.
Shifting gears to conclude. This is our final question.
I feel like a schmuck and a half because what I'm about to say is, might come off as mildly critical.
Come on.
This has also been, it's a bit intimidating to come up here because there are not one but two people that I greatly admire on the stage.
Well, I'm going to go over here.
Hell of a thing.
Divide and conquer, Wally.
And so, Thorben, I wanted to ask you about Hill Street Blues and whatnot, okay, of that show you've been working on. And this is a question about women. I've been watching NYPD Blue and Deadwood downloaded. I'm sorry. lately, we can't afford HBO at my house, and it's an extraordinary feeling to be in an environment of eloquent masculinity of a kind that I didn't really experience as a kid. And by the time I got to college, I got sort of eloquent something in the middle.
Yeah.
From my housemates and whatnot, but I always wonder. Where it seems like someone like Sipowicz, someone like, even like John Kelly, certainly Swearengen, are these whole consciousnesses. But I wonder.
Where's the women?
Basically. Or, I mean, and the women are clearly there, but none of them ever have ever struck me as being all the way there. And I wonder if you're... It's partially a question about writing... This is hard as hell, man. This is partially a question about the writing process. When you are sort of reaching out to this consciousness of a character that you're creating, do you find... Is there a barrier there? Is there a kind of... is there a gulf that you experience? Or is it just a matter of trying to relate to just the practical, I have this set of experiences directly applicable to a fictionalized male character?
Yeah.
And is that a responsibility that you feel remains for you, or do you see that there are challenges?
Well,
I
feel no abstract responsibility, you know, to count votes about how many credible female characters.
Right. No, that's not what I mean.
I think that I'm the product of a society which obviously in which women are not given the opportunity to develop as fully in ways that are accessible to my understanding. But I try to... the character of Alma Garrett in Deadwood is a pretty complicated figure. The character of Calamity Jane, I believe, is pretty complicated. The character of Stubbs becomes pretty complicated. She was a real figure, too. But
is that the Swearingen's girlfriend?
No, that's Trixie.
Well, Trixie's a complicated character.
Yeah, Trixie's pretty complicated too. But the fact is that there are stunted affects in the women characters in the worlds that I write about, because women are encouraged to believe that they exist as adjuncts of the male will or the male fantasy. And it wasn't just the prostitutes in Deadwood, but in society times around this time, women were imprisoned in a different way. They were imprisoned in bustles and all kinds of treated with this sort of elevated rhetoric, which in fact was incapacitating to them. They were idealized. You know, Alice James' diary is a wonderful document in that regard, and she found that only once she had begun to die of a tumor that she discovered her voice, Henry and William James' younger sister. Hysteria literally is derived from of the womb. That it is, so that when a woman began to feel as if she were thwarted, she was diagnosed as being hysterical, which is simply to say her womb was driving her, and they would give her opium, which was the treatment, the accepted treatment for hysteria. I take the characters as I find them. I'm sure that now Alma, as it turns out, becomes a writer in the fourth season, and she is encouraged by another character who actually came to the camp in the first year, but for whom I would not settle until we got the right actor. He was a theatrical producer named Jack Langreesh, who's played by Brian Cox, who appears in the third season. And Langreesh encouraged Alma to resume what she had lied about as her original impulse coming out there, which was to be a writer. And there's a good deal of sort of Willa Cather's experience that I hope to mine for the character of Alma Garrett. But I don't know if I've answered your question. It's always an admixture of the limitations of the artist's own imagination and sort of the psychic cards that he's been dealt and the prevailing conventions of the time. I wish I had one answer for it. Well, I'll try to do better.
That was fine.
But okay. they are very Thanks. Masculine worlds, and they are.
Yeah.
And this world is a Victorian one in which women are not equal to men. I want to thank David Milch very much for this candid. I want to thank the audience.
And thank you so much. And let me thank you. And let me say from my heart. Please engage in the things we're talking about. Don't give up on mass culture. Contribute to it. break your heart in trying to make it better instead of standing outside it. Our species is in a fight for its life. And, you know, nobody says that the decision is going to go one way or another. So put your bodies up and put your spirits up and get in touch with me if you, you know, I'm very open to that kind of stuff and anything that you want to do, you know, just feel as if this stuff about that we don't have the vote anymore, we're just not voting in the right election, you know, and you can all, you all come and vote with me, okay?